Hello and welcome back to the White People Podcast. I'm ZM. It is Sunday, the 19th of November, 2023. And I'm going to read this week's text, which is thankfully another portrait. I love doing these. The others have been written as like kind of fiction. Like I've written them like they are stories. This one I've taken a bit of a different approach. It's written as, I guess, just dialogue. Like it's just a transcript from a fictional lecture, and I hope I'm not like giving the game away, like the conceit of the text away by like saying, oh, it's a fictional lecture, but yeah, it is. So I'm just gonna get to reading it, and then at the end I will give you the emoji to comment on the Instagram post if you've listened to the whole thing. Or like tweet if you're a Twitter person. Oh, an X person. To send us on X if you're an X person. But yeah, I'll give you the emoji, which is just, yeah, fun game we play to kind of, I don't know, get a sense of who's reading these things. How many of you are there? We don't really ever know if anyone ever is actually reading it, but it's always nice to know. Just to see, just a fun game. But yeah, excuse my voice, by the way. I've been losing my voice for like the past 3 weeks. It's just occasionally it'll just go. So hopefully if I stay in a lower register, it'll be normal. So I will talk like this and then you won't hear my squeaky voice. Okay, I'll shut up. I'll get reading. Hello, and welcome to another Sunday lecture. This week, we've got a representative from the Artist Co-op. They're here to speak to you about what they do, how they do it, and maybe also how you can do it too. They'll chat, and then hopefully we've got some time for questions from the audience. That's you. So I'll hand over to them, and if we could show them a warm welcome with a round of applause. Hey, yeah, thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me. Like your tutor said, I'm going to chat about our artist co-op here in London. Cast your minds back to the 90s, which actually, that's before some of you were born. That's depressing. We started off as painters in studios. Originally a group of friends. We'd all just tipped out of colleges in London, so BAs or MAs in those sort of pre-made networks of peer groups. Someone I knew took a part-time job for a small graphic design company run by a really eccentric gentleman, quite a character. He used to have wine for lunch and he'd play the piano after he'd had his wine and his wife would sing. They were an unconventional couple running a very small business, employing, you know, artists. Also unconventional, or so I've heard. They needed premises, so they signed a very, very insecure lease for some offices in King's Cross, and it has a huge warehouse, but it was really very cheap, and the rent was being paid to British Rail, which doesn't exist anymore, so you might not have heard of them, but they were a state-funded organisation. Those don't exist anymore. You might not have heard of that. So it was cheap and insecure. There was something like a 6-month break clause, and they could be thrown out at any time. For context, there had been quite a small recession at the beginning of the 90s, so this sort of thing was happening a bit. Lots of affordable warehouses and offices, lots of artists setting up in buildings, generally in smaller groups. We were 20, maybe 25 people, yeah. Damien Hirst famously did his Freeze exhibition. The magazine and the art fair all came later, but the title, Freeze, originally came from that exhibition that he did in a warehouse in southeast London. So it was kind of in the air. But the eccentric graphic designer rolled up with his piano and his singing wife, and all these artists he was employing asked him what he was going to do with the warehouse space. You know how it goes. We've got lots of friends who would probably love to come and make their art here. And he goes, oh, do you think they'd pay some rent? They roll their eyes and say, oh, yeah. Got everyone on the phone in a meeting. A few of us had a bit of DIY understanding and we organised a working party. It was full up within half a week. Obviously, because the rent was so cheap and it was so central. But it was also exciting. The eccentric graphic designer paid for the materials and we built a bunch of walls to divide the space up into some studios. It was really quite an undertaking. I don't know if you've ever built a wall before. Knackering job. And we ended up with a large corridor in the middle, which became a gallery. Well, we wanted it to function as a gallery. the rent was so low, we could just waste the space in that way. It didn't have to be productive. We had the luxury of a gallery. I mean, that was all once we eventually got round to finishing off the building bits and painting it all and organising everything into some exhibitions in a very haphazard way. It took a while to get everything together, but we did. And then we got a notice to quit from British Rail about 4 months later. They wanted to demolish the building. It was King's Cross, remember? Back then, it was all phase one of probably 60 phases where they were looking at redeveloping the area, starting with the Channel Tunnel and on until today. 30 years later, I guess we can all look back and say it took a while, but that's the sort of scale you're looking at when you're redeveloping whole areas of large cities. We were just a tiny cog in that machine, but it galvanised us to fight. We lobbied the council. Luckily, it being Camden and a Labour council, they were sympathetic. Lobbied them and the planning committee and managed to get a bit of publicity. An emerging co-op of artists generated a bit of public sympathy. And so we used that bit of leverage and held them over a barrel for a bit. They said, we can't give you any money because we're a state-funded public organisation, but we can pick up bills. So if you find somewhere else you'd like to move to ... Better than nothing, I guess. We found a new building, signed the lease, and British Rail helped sort of facilitate it all. They paid for Pickford's, a posh removal company, to move all our stuff, and they picked up the bills for that. That's where all that public money was going back in the 90s. But within 12 months, we had to rebuild all those walls, just do it all over again. We were all in our 20s, didn't have mortgages or kids or even jobs, like careers, really. People did have time to give, and the collective energy and spirit was, fuck it, let's go for it. The lease on the new place was only 18 months, but we could see that there was a chance to build it properly the second time around. We had all those lessons we'd learnt from the first time building it. We actually designed the gallery this time rather than just putting up a row of sheds, so it was finished and done better, less makeshift. We put a bit more effort into the actual gallery programme too, in that there actually was one. We knew the first three exhibitions were critical. They had to be good and coherent. If that worked, we could get a bit of a profile, people would come, a bit of publicity. We decided very early on that we weren't going to put on shows of our own work. There were too many of us, maybe around 30 now, and we didn't want the gallery to be seen as vanity publishing. We wanted it to be more ambitious and serious and actually cooler than that. So, new rule, we just would not show anyone who was a member, and that rule still applies today. But then the question was, who do we show and how do we make decisions about that? So we needed a third party decider or a curator. At the time, intellectually speaking, there was a rise of this curatorial turn, the idea of artists as curators or art historians or critics as curators. Before that, curators had been a sort of fusty, fossilised thing. They only really existed in museums. Back in the 90s, it suddenly became a much more creative thing where you could frame an exhibition and give a different meaning to an individual work of art or its context and all that. So, although we understand now that it's a thing, I remember when it wasn't. But having a curator at the organisation, that was born out of necessity from the self-flagellation of our no-member rules, of our no-member shows rule. We got three different curators in to do the first three shows, and 30 years on, it's become part of our identity, but it started life as a very practical solution to a problem. Anyway, we moved buildings two more times. First, back to King's Cross, where we stayed for about 7 years. That's where the first Arts Council applications were made. The gallery was in the basement, and we could throw wild parties because King's Cross was a bit of a clubbing hotspot, not really residential. It was actually a building on a street corner surrounded by three pubs, so no one cared about the noise we were making. And then the second move was only up Pentonville Road to where we are now in Islington. But it's all a bit upmarket now. We're a lot closer to being an institution than we were back then. Probably still a long way off, but there you go. That's the quick history. Now, I'll give you a quick overview and we can get into specifics. We still think of ourselves as that warehouse full of artist studios. From the outside, you might be more aware of us as a gallery, but we're still a home for 30 or so artists with studios of varying sizes. People pay for what they can afford, and all renting artists are members of the co-op with a vote in what happens and what direction it all goes in. We've got a public gallery with exhibitions and events. There's a curatorial bursary programme, an education programme where we do outreach with local schools and work with older people. We also have artists in the community programs, sort of similar to artists in residence in the community, in schools, all over the place and wherever you want us, really. We get Arts Council funding, which has been coming into the co-op since the late 90s. Now we have national portfolio status, so every 4 years it's up for review. That and philanthropic foundation funding for a relatively new initiative called the Civic Fellowship. So now we have curatorial bursary fellows, which we've had for a long time, and also the Civic Fellowship. I'll give you a bit of information about our structure. A lot of it's just pragmatism, really. You know, it comes down to the problem solving at the time. We started off very amateur, a bit disorganised, didn't really know where we were heading as a group, as an organisation, because, you know, that's not really what you're thinking about at the start. And if you are, then that's quite weird. We didn't really have any clear objectives. We were just interested in having affordable studios, and that was the main impetus. The rest came along later. Okay, yes. Next slide. Yeah, so we are a registered charity and a registered company. The company came first. We only became a charity a few years down the line. As a company, we're limited by guarantee, which means basically there's no shares and it's not for profit. I'll get into that in a bit. But most galleries and arts organisations are registered charities. Becoming a charity takes quite a long time. It's quite a lengthy administrative process. The application requires a sort of fair amount of grown-up strategic thinking and planning. To become a limited company is pretty easy in comparison. You just fill in a one-page form and send it off, basically. Someone signs it while they're having their lunch. I mean, kind of. You have to anoint a secretary and a couple of directors, but it's actually not that hard. You just name people. We just said, oh, I'll do that, they'll do that, you do that, and then it's done. We could go forward and say to whoever we had to negotiate with, landlord or funding body or whoever, this is who we are. We are this entity. We'd like to sign a lease, etc. Because so much of being an organisation is convincing people in power that you're responsible and you can afford to pay them when you say you will and that you're good for your word and all that. When we registered as a company, I just want to say it's not about capitalism. You've got to be a collective or legal entity to start with to sign a commercial lease. Doing it that way was much more achievable in the short term for us, because when you're a very new, young, fresh organisation, you don't have much collective experience between you. I don't know if it's possible to start something from the deep end, you know? All the rest of it is something you kind of grow into if it suits you, but you have time to get all that grown-up business stuff sorted. You don't have to do it on day one. I think also, if you put it off, you can do it once you have a bit of a track record. If you keep going, you can say, look, we've done this, this is our work, these are our objectives, and this is what we're about, this is our identity. To have all of that in your mind at the beginning is not really possible. We've also found that becoming a registered charity has brought some limitations which didn't exist when we started in the 90s. Some laws came along in 2014 that mean you cannot be both a charity and a co-op. So although we are a co-op, we can't be legally or formally registered on the directory of UK cooperatives. Oh, right. So I can see a few confused faces. Should I take a minute to actually explain what a co-op is? Yeah? Okay. It's generally and officially, it's an autonomous association where people come together to meet their common needs and aspirations through a jointly owned and democratically controlled enterprise. Yeah? That's like the formal. In a business sense, it's a way of running a company where it's owned and directed by the people who work there. It's pretty cool, pretty nice way of working if you're into it. But yeah, we can't be legally registered as a co-op because of the registered charity status, which we need to have because of the funding stuff. But we aspire to and we identify with the idea of the cooperative model. It is an attempt at a flat management structure with everyone involved in decision-making, working together for the good of the organisation and cooperating. We don't need a legal document to do that. So we still say we're a co-op and still basically run things like a co-op. The cooperative ethos is part of the vernacular of the community in the studios and in the building, even to the extent that we all share the same toilets, the same corridors, and so people bump into each other in a very democratic way. But on the level of governance, that's a word organisations are really interested in at the moment. For our governance structure, we have a board of trustees because we are a registered charity, and those trustees also double as directors because we are both a charity and a limited company. obviously not for profit, not about capitalism, but in a business context, we use our surplus, not that we have very much, but there is some, to benefit the members, and that is put back into the building. Basically, we have a very onerous kind of rental agreement, a fully repairing commercial lease, which is another little bit of realism you may have to deal with once you graduate. We have about 32 co-op members and about 12 directors, trustees. I say about because after 30 years, people come and go, but that's the general ratio. Now, when you join, you're renting the studio as a tenant, but you're also becoming a member of the co-op. All of our members sign a license agreement when they rent a studio. They agree to a couple of things, that you have to actively use it, not just use it for storage. Difficult to navigate what that means in practice, but we'll get onto that. You also need to give time to run the co-op and help it meet its objectives. We ask for up to 2 days a month, whether it's more or less in reality and in practice, well, that depends. Also, members all have a vote when it comes to big meetings and where we decide on the direction of the organisation. So it's interesting. We might not be registered formally, but you can still build the cooperative ethos into the formal structures and governance with things like tenancy agreements or licences. That vote is there so the directors aren't just dictating down to members about what's going on. The members can contribute to the co-op and help shape its direction, its ethos and its character. Our structure disempowers the trustees to some extent because they can be outvoted by the members if they disagree. But that doesn't mean it's like us against them. Most of us are generally quite happy to step back a little bit and allow a board of trustees to take on responsibility for strategic direction and governance. Members have to be quite self-confident to kick up a stink and outvote the directors if they disagree. But it's never actually come to that kind of confrontational moment. I guess because we have a structure that makes sure the directors, trustees talk to the members, you know, through committees and committee chairs and stuff. Also, generally speaking, we're all quite polite, nice people. We don't go around picking fights and being stroppy. If there's any disagreement, it's all done in a relatively subtle way. Members do make their feelings known occasionally, and the trustees are receptive enough to pick up on the general mood of the membership, and they take it on board, so it doesn't escalate to a conflict. Like, it's literally never been us against them at a meeting with the whole board and membership involved. There have been frank conversations and direct words, but in practice, it's all quite civilised, really. I guess that's the whole point of the structure, isn't it? Like, it's like a check or a balance. The structure itself means that informal methods work because they're formally backed up. Members feel comfortable speaking up because they know their opinion will be taken seriously and considered rather than disregarded. The structure itself with the vote and the ratio is kind of just like a fail-safe more than the way every single decision is made. That's actually a point worth making. As we've gone on, we've obviously held on to that flat management structure, but we've also had to acknowledge the need for a certain amount of quasi-hierarchy. If you have 30 or so people sitting in a circle to debate every single decision, it just takes too long to achieve consensus on every tiny thing. We'd be in meetings that went on for 4 hours, and as we got older, that started to feel a bit ridiculous. None of us were convinced it was necessary to make every single decision that way. It's much easier to allocate jobs to smaller groups and make decisions that way. So we've got three committees. The SMC, the Studio Management Committee, they look after the building, look after the members, recruit new members when someone leaves, things like that. There's the Operations Committee. They're everything to do with money, so money for public programmes, money for the building, the bills, the utilities, repairs, fundraising, everything really. And the Public Programmes Committee, which has been unified under the leadership of a Director of Public Programmes. And that's a role which didn't exist before. We had the gallery arm and the education arm, and it wasn't working very well. But the DPP makes decisions about direction and organises things. The Public Programme Committee chip in when they're needed. They sit on bursary interview panels and things like that. But mostly we've professionalised the public programme stuff. And yeah, I think that's been something we've had to strike a balance with, the blend of amateurism and professionalism. It's really hard to run something well if you're relying on voluntary work, especially if it's time sensitive or important or public facing. You actually can't ask people for too much. So we don't use volunteers or members for invigilation. We pay invigilators. We also have the Director of Public Programmes, as I mentioned, and a few other paid programming roles. So we have this mix of employed staff who work for the co-op and members who are members of the co-op. They all have skin in the game, but in different ways. Members are volunteering their time as part of their obligations that come with their membership. Employees have stakes when it comes to not just obligations or expectations, but like they have employment rights. It could be hard to balance that. I don't know. I'm not sure how many artist co-ops there are out there with a similar setup where they're blending the professional, the non-professional, volunteering members, flat management, cooperative ethos. We've resisted having a single director as the organisation's figurehead over the years. It's been a choice we've consistently made. At times, it's felt almost obstinate. There's been a culture of funding, at least for NPOs, that kind of implies a director as a figurehead is very, very preferable. I think that obstinance is part of the balance we're striking too. But yeah, all 32 artist members are on one of those three committees and therefore have an obligation to attend meetings around 6 times a year. That can be a bit difficult to manage and balance too. There can be an uneven level of contribution from members. Some people take on real managerial organisational responsibility. Some people clean the fridge. We rotate through that cycle of heavy lifting and menial jobs every 3 or 4 years or so. Realistically, it's difficult to police that, and we are sensitive to the way people have periods of their lives where they have more or less time to give. It's a tricky one, but I think that flexibility is one of the things that makes us resilient. I think the entire reason we've survived this long as an organisation, it really is a sort of pragmatism or resilience. It's like a part of the co-op's character. When you're a small group, the energy can run out. People want to do other things that are a bit more of their own or in a different direction. But we can accommodate people stepping away for a while because others step up. It can be more cyclical or regenerative and sustainable in that way. I know we ask for people to actively use their studios, and it can be hard to formally nail down what that means. But in practice, it's just about getting to know people and figuring it out organically. We're welcoming and friendly and cheesy, but it's a community. We understand that circumstances change and you start new jobs or you have babies or you get sick or someone else gets sick and you need to care for them. If you can't give anything back to the community for a bit because of that, we're not going to give you a hard time. We understand that being accommodating makes us more resilient. It's something that feels hard won. Surviving in a capital city under all the neoliberalism and capitalism and money. You have to fight your corner and find ways of solving problems and either making money, generating money, or doing things incredibly cheaply that would otherwise cost lots of money. So you just find ways of being self-reliant and making do, DIY and all that. It's a way of working that lends itself to taking risks. It rewards risk. We say we take risks, which in an immediate sense, it means being responsive. We're small enough to be responsive and adapt to crises. But I think through the years, we've seen both the crises and our response to it kick off a kind of cycle of dynamism. And that transfers across into the gallery programme in some way. That conceptual stuff is less tangible. The momentum of 20th century avant-garde culture as a framework of ideas, a paradigm that's probably coming to an end anyway, but the idea of challenging the front runner or subverting received wisdoms and ways of doing things. There are a number of artists over the years who've come from our studios or who've shown in the gallery that have gone on to do really well. Turner Prize shortlists or even winning international careers. Our curatorial bursary holders have gone on to other jobs in important influential places. That conceptual or curatorial risk-taking is something we're really proud of. I think rightly so, but for us, it's really a case of necessity is the mother of invention. When we take creative risks, it's usually in order to survive. It's not out of nowhere. It's a question of pragmatism, resilience. But I think that resilience is getting harder to build in. Capital city, neoliberalism, capitalism. London is such a highly financialized entity. How do you set up shop anywhere when there's that whole business about artists and regeneration, you know? the artists move into a derelict area and have their studios and little cafes and make nice little environments where people are buying cappuccinos and pot plants and it's all trendy and vibey. And then ordinary middle-class professionals who can afford to buy homes want to live there because they want to be near the cool, trendy vibe. Developers have made a lot of profit out of that cycle. It's rarely artists that make the money. Throughout our 30-year history, that's gone from being something that artists knew but no one else acknowledged to it now being built into town planning and council strategies. They're taking the onus to create affordable workspaces, not to be nice to artists, but to convince developers that they'll make money. I think there has to be a way artists can leverage that to get what they need, some kind of symbiotic pragmatism. I know, it doesn't look good. Prices are crazy, rents are higher, there aren't as many empty warehouses, there is, I don't know, you might have heard of this, the donut ring phenomenon? Yeah? Like, London is a donut shape with a series of rings. The centre of, or like, the hole in the middle of the donut, that's always the most prosperous bit. The artists and their studios were always in the actual donut itself, the next ring out, but even that bit's getting too expensive, isn't it? And you can't go any further out because then that's the shires, you know, the home counties, and prices go back up because of the commuter belt. So the donut ring itself has been exhausted, like Stratford, as an example. It was full of warehouses and artists for decades, and now it's the Olympic Park. So things have changed. I think artists might maybe have to move out of London entirely. If there's any young peer group out in the audience, if you want to do something similar, that'd be my advice. Little artistic communities are forming outside of London where it's much, much, much more affordable. And I think that'll be how it can work somewhere still in whatever makeshift way. I'll also say it only stays makeshift for a while. You can get more stable and more professional or more proper as you go, but you've got to get going. Okay, I think I'm running out of time, am I? Yeah, cool. I'll wrap up. That's about it. My parting words are that it's hard out there, but my best advice would be that pragmatism. It might not be politically perfect, but it's a way to actually realistically survive. You can use capitalism as a means to an end, which, let me explain. If you want to live in a place like London and not be a victim of it, you have to work with the flow of the tide. Capitalism is bigger than us. Use it for your own purposes. Learn how to think like a capitalist. It doesn't mean you have to believe in it all or love it, but there's nothing inherently wrong with artists being more business savvy. Use the system to help you get to your objective rather than trying to fight it, because it always wins. Political perfection is nice as an idea, but for the most part, London just doesn't accommodate it. Okay, that's me. I think we're taking questions now, yeah? Okay, yeah. Thank you for having me. Okay, that's the text. Thank you for listening and taking the time out of your Sunday or whenever day you're listening to this on. I will give you, very shortly, I will give you the emoji to comment on the Instagram and or in reply to the tweet announcing this text or like about this text. But I will say, if you, like, normally this would be the bit, if this was an actual lecture, this would be the bit where you, the audience, ask questions. And because this is like a text on a website, audio on a podcast, you can't really do that, which is kind of shit. I can't really answer those questions for you because, like, this is a portrait of a real person. And I'm not them. I can't answer on their behalf. But I still think that there should be space for, yeah, those questions. I think it'd be an interesting exercise if you do have questions for our lecturer. Although I cannot answer them, what are they? So if you have a question and you're going to send an emoji anyway, please give me the emoji and your question. And can the emoji be, you know, in the people section, there's like that, like, it's like a teacher. They're holding a book, they've got glasses, they're standing in front of a whiteboard or blackboard. And there's three options. Either that or the graduate with like the black square cap. three options for that. I think because it's like, you know, it's a bit, you know, seminar style, lecture style. It's like got that way of, I don't know, I guess, speaking that involves you being a polite intellectual audience, and the speaker is this person with authority. It's got like, it was, yeah, really interesting throwing my voice into that shape. And I don't know, it's just, it's always interesting thinking about, for me at least, I mean, you might not be interested in this, but for me at least, it's always interesting thinking about the choices I am making when I write about something in a particular way, because it's not just like, I'm not just choosing what to write about or like, you know, what I'm actually saying, I'm also choosing how I'm writing about it, and like that has implications for the text. And I think the rest of the portraits, yeah, like I said, they've been written as kind of fiction, short story, narrative fiction, like they've been, oh, so-and-so does this, they do this. It's from the position of like a disembodied narrator, who's usually me, like the interlocutor in those portrait situations. But it's always like, you know, my reflections are there. And like as the narrator, like I reflect on things that the person's saying. And there's none of that with this one. It's just kind of like direct speech from the person. Well, not direct speech, but you know what I mean? Like you receive it as like speech, dialogue from the person with none of my reflections, you know, obviously. I've obviously built my reflections in, but it was just interesting writing it in that way and trying to build in like these different like ways of showing that it's like spoken speech, like it's spoken words rather than the written word, which is like, you know, the speech is always more formal than written text. So like the little things like that I think were interesting with this one. And yeah, I really enjoyed writing this one. Thank you for listening. I will stop chatting away about the text that I've just read, because I imagine these are all things that you know already. Let me know your questions for our lecturer and the emoji, the teacher or the graduate, and have a nice rest of your Sunday. Okay, love you. Bye.